You've landed Inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Oh, hello, Launch Street. Tamara here. Today, we are going to the dark web. Mwahaha. Okay, not really. But we're going to talk to someone in the cybersecurity space. Before we do, remember how you innovate is how you perform at your peak, add value, and stand out in this noisy world. Don't leave this incredibly important and natural skill up to chance. I want you to go to our website, go to launchstreet.com, G-O-T-O, launchstreet.com, and discover exactly how you innovate. It's that important. You can't settle for being average anymore. Go up your innovation game, because as we're talking about today, it's how you stay ahead of the curve. Now back to cybersecurity. Our guest, Christina Bergman, is all about cybersecurity. And the reason I wanted to talk to her today isn't actually for her cybersecurity knowledge, although it's fascinating, but because she is on the forefront of a changing industry. I mean, think how quickly technology moves and changes, particularly in this area. She figured out a niche that nobody was serving and went for it. And that's something that we can all learn from, regardless of the industry we work in. So Christina Bergman laid the foundation for what would become Integris Software, spurred by Edward Snowden's revelations and the public outcry prior to the introduction of GDPR. Don't worry if you don't know what that is. We'll get into it in the podcast. She recognized that privacy was a big data problem and enterprises were blind to the risk it poses to their business. So prior to Integris Software, Christina was a venture capitalist at Ignition Partners, where she led investments in cloud tech, big data, security, the list goes on. But as I said, what's interesting about today's interview isn't just some fascinating facts about cybersecurity and privacy and how we're all at risk, but also how she figured out a niche in a changing category. Okay, to the web. All right, maybe not to the web, but at least to this interview.
Christina, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so looking forward to our conversation.
Likewise. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right. So what's your favorite innovative brand or business? And just tell me why you love it so much.
Yeah, I think my favorite brand is Honest Co. And part of it is being a mother of a toddler and soon to be a mother of number two. I'm always concerned about what is going on my child, around my child, in my child. And so having a brand where I feel like the ethics behind it are very sound and very clear, and they're just being really upfront about what's included in their products, that to me makes me feel more comfortable, especially given that the founder and CEO is a mother herself. And the reason behind starting it was for that exact reason. She wanted to know what she was putting on and around her child. And that just resonated with me. I like it when people are just really upfront about what's in there and do their best to make sure that it's ethical and clean and keeps the kids healthy.
You know, I love that. My kids are now 10 and 14, so I'm out of that state, the stage of worrying about all that stuff, but I know what you mean. And what I find really interesting about the example is what you said just now, which is they're crystal clear about kind of who they are and what they stand for. And that happens to resonate with you because it could have been something that doesn't work for you, and that's fine too. And I think that that's becoming more and more important in that relationship between people and brands, whether it's B2B, business to business, or business to consumer, is being crystal clear of kind of who you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And quite frankly, in our industry, which is data privacy, that is the entire crux around the change in public opinion with respect to people's personal data. Is you just have to be really crisp and really clear with people about what you have, what you're doing with it, how you're using it. And that in itself, that transparency, will breed trust. And when companies think about what does that mean to them in their industry, that trust with their consumers is something that some folks, quite frankly, don't do a great job of. There's a certain social networking site that's getting a bit hammered in the news these days.
We won't say who they are, but they start with the
right.
Test, maybe.
Yeah. He who shall not be named, Voldemort, is getting a little bit hammered. But companies that are doing a good job of being really communicative and proactive and taking public stances and then following through with their actions, they're actually getting quite a bit of brand uplift because of that. Because, you know, consumers are smart, they're savvy, and they want to work with people who align with their ethical standards.
Do you think that's a matter of being crystal clear, or and maybe this isn't an either or question, or is that a matter of not selling, you know what I mean? Like that's kind of the issue, right? It's like, I'll give you my information, but I want you to keep it to yourself.
Yeah, I think it is a matter of being crystal clear, because there's certain things that I think most consumers, I would say, may not be aware gets done with their data. And when you explain it, it makes perfect sense. But if they find out and it hasn't been explained in advance, it can be shocking and upsetting. You know, something as simple as, let's say I go and switch cell phone providers. Well, in that process, they're going to share my data with credit rating agencies to check on my creditworthiness on whether or not I can pay my cell phone bill. And there might be some other parties in there that they share it with for very legitimate reasons. But what I want to know as a consumer is, who exactly is that getting shared with, and am I okay with it? And if I'm the one in control making that informed decision, then I feel much better about it and I feel like there's parameters. Whereas if I get an opaque answer back from the company, no clarity, no communication, no really good answers on what's happening, I'm not going to feel good about it. And if I find out about it later, I'm probably going to be upset because they weren't clear and upfront with me. So I don't think it's really an either or. I think it's a communication issue and just being really upfront and transparent about what you're doing. Most companies understand because, you know, most consumers understand because most companies aren't doing something that's nefarious by nature. They're doing it because there's a reason. And just being clear about what that reason is will help consumers make really informed decisions.
Well, I have to say, what I really appreciate about what you're saying is that this topic is actually a personal one, not just algorithms and data. And like, that's all important. But at the end of the day, that's my data. So I want to back us up for a second because we kind of launched in very naturally, but I want to talk a little bit about Integra Software, just what it is, but more importantly, what inspired you to start it?
Yeah, well, that's actually kind of an interesting story. So this is my third company that I'm in data software, business intelligence, data management, and cloud technology at a variety of companies. And then I spent about 4 years in venture capital investing in cloud, big data, IoT, and security companies. And one of the things that is just kind of a known fact in the VC industry is that anytime there's either major technology shift or major shift in public opinion, that opens up a whole breadth of opportunities for entrepreneurs. And one of the things that I was watching was in the post-Edward Snowden world, how shocked people were at how much data was out there about them and being collected. And I was shocked that everybody else was shocked at first. And then I realized, oh, right, not everybody works in data. Not everybody's going to be aware of what's being done. And so I started to pay attention to what was happening both in the news and then within companies. And what I saw was Angela Merkel visibly angry at a press conference. And that's pretty difficult because she's fairly stone-faced. And I thought, huh, there's probably going to be backlash on this. I wonder what that's going to be. It's probably going to be in regulation because they've just made a bunch of governments mad. And sure enough, this thing called GDPR came out. And I read through the first draft of it and thought, wow, they're going to fine companies 4% of their global revenue if they violate people's privacy. And I started reading through what the expectations were. And it was very clear this was written by lawyers, not technologists, because as somebody with a technology background, I was thinking everything they're asking companies to do is completely the opposite of every best practice we've been selling for the last 2-3 decades around data management. Best practices are things like you have lots of copies of the data, you've got backups and redundancies, You've got secondary systems so that if one system fails, it automatically flips over to the other one that's still running an exact copy of everything there. You've got geographically dispersed data so that if there's a natural disaster in one part of the world, you don't lose all your data. It's still stored somewhere else in at least one other, if not three other locations. And so all these best practices we've been selling for making sure that we don't lose people's data and making sure that data flows like water throughout a system is now going to become a liability under this law, because you have to not only know what you have, which nobody does, you have to be able to find it and delete it. And that exercise of finding it and deleting it is going to be exponentially more expensive than just keeping it. So that was what got me into looking into this industry. And as part of my research, I talked to about 50 Fortune 500 companies and asked them the same five questions. Is this a problem? How are you dealing with it? What are the technical challenges to dealing with it? Are you using any technology today, or could you repurpose technology to solve this? And then last but not least, would you pay for it? Because nobody's going to pay for it. There's no market there. And across all industries, it was the same five answers. It was, yes, it was a problem. Don't know how to deal with it. The technical challenges are that we have no idea where our data is, what we have, what it's being used for, let alone whether or not we're in compliance with any policies or regulations. And then to the fourth question, security software helps you secure the outside, but it doesn't tell you what's on the inside. And last but not least, yes, of course we'd pay for it. 4% of revenue is a big, scary number, but we're also concerned about brand and reputation risk. We don't want to be on the front page of the journal for violating our customers' trust. We want to do the right thing. So I spent about 2 years looking for a company to invest in and found absolutely nothing. State of the art was spreadsheets and survey tools. Nothing was actually interrogating the data itself and giving anybody any kind of an idea what they had. And so when GDPR passed into law, I thought, well, I know how to build products, I know how to raise money, and I know who to raise money from. And so off I went and started the company.
So I'm intrigued by a few things that you just said that I just want to dig a little bit deeper into, because I think they're important for all of us in terms of finding a market gap and then doing something about it. Because the one of the first things you said in there is that you actually did a ton of research, really, right? You talked to your potential clients. And I think, actually, let me say this as a question. You didn't know what you were going to do, right? Is that correct? Like, you were looking for the hole in the marketplace. And I think sometimes we wait until we think we know the answer to go ask for feedback. But then we kind of have a tendency to miss the opportunity when we do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And really what you're trying to define is the white space. Like, where is the gap between expectations and reality? And a lot of that requires just qualitative research. You can't go out and say what percentage of companies do FUBAR, because chances are they're not even thinking about FUBAR, whatever that is.
Yeah,
so you
right.
have to go and figure out, okay, where's the gap between expectation and reality? And how do you define that? How do you put your arms around that? And that's a very qualitative kind of a discussion where you have to talk to a lot of people to start to see a pattern. And it was in talking to those people that the pattern emerged that they don't know what data they have, they don't know where it is, and they can't tie it back to any kind of a regulation. The business side and the legal side of an organization is completely disconnected from the technology side. The legal department that works on privacy might be saying, this is our policy, this is our procedure for dealing with this aspect of people's personal information. But then it falls off a cliff and never gets operationalized within the technology landscape. And that was the biggest challenge at the time. And this was, you know, going back 5-6 years, is there was absolutely nothing tying those two functions together within a company. The technology team was doing their best practices around data management and making sure they had lots of copies. And the legal team was doing their jobs and making sure they had the right policies and procedures. And those two didn't connect. And that was the big market opportunity, because their way of dealing with it was extremely manual. And when you see something that is extremely manual and there is enabling technology to automate it, and you can pull that enabling technology together to automate that, give them greater clarity and help them deal with something that is a major impending event like GDPR coming into effect and a 4% of revenue fine, well, you've got a catalyst for action. You've got a catalyst for people figuring out how to bridge that gap. And that urgency and that need is something that you can build towards. Because in venture, we have a bit of a saying, you never want to sell a vitamin, you always want to sell a painkiller. people need painkillers. They'll drive to the store to get Tylenol. They're not going to drive to the store to get vitamins. They'll get that whenever they remember it the next time, maybe. So you always want to be selling painkillers, and those painkillers that solve a white space problem where your competition is effectively a manual process, that's a huge opportunity for innovation.
It's funny that you say that, because it brought me back to some old research I did in the health and wellness category. And the whole vitamin thing, what people, and I think this is true in kind of what you're saying, what people say, like moving towards the benefit is, we as humans, we move away from pain versus moving towards the benefit. And we could always get people in focus groups to say, yeah, I take vitamins. Yeah, it's important. But when you really track their habits, they weren't doing it, right? So kind of to your point, it's all about pain. Here's my question for you, though. So with GDPR, and for those listening, most of you probably have never or don't know what that lingo is. Just know that it's new privacy laws that have come out that are very strict and have, to your point, Christina's point, consequences. And I'm hyper aware of them, because with what we do in the assessment, that we want to be in line with that. And I think actually they're really, from a consumer perspective, they're actually good laws. They're really helpful. So, but here's what the struggle that I had, and I'm probably not as sophisticated as the big companies you were dealing with, but I knew the GDPR was there. I knew I had some stuff to do. I knew I had these problems when I first started looking at it, but I didn't even know what questions to ask. How did you get your clients kind of, once you identified that white space need, how did you get them on board to, here's a solution, when I think sometimes when those shifts happen, we just don't even know what to ask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a challenge. And early on, when GDPR, which stands for the General Data Protection Regulation, and it applies to EU residents, when that first came online, there was a lot of confusion around, how do people even approach this? Who's responsible for it? What does my working team look like? I don't know what questions to ask. But as people started to read through it more and more and dissect it, a general consensus started to form that there's some baseline things the legal department needs to do, and there's some baseline things the technology teams need to do. And as we've moved into a point in time where things like the California Consumer Protection Act has been passed into law and comes into effect at the beginning of January, CCPA, as it's called, that has spurred on another wave of action and another wave of people trying to figure out, how do we deal with this? And that has benefited a lot from the work that people did with GDPR, where there was a consensus form that, okay, you need technology to be able to find your data and know it's there, but you also need to be able to manage your processes and procedures and policies as well, in addition to that, and you need to have these cross-functional working teams. The early days are a little bit messy, and quite frankly, in a brand new market, as a software company, we don't always know what questions we need to help them answer. But through a series of conversations, kind of like in that qualitative research at the beginning, you start to see patterns of behavior emerge. And those patterns of what's successful and what's not becomes your advice. Of, here's what I've seen other companies do that worked well. And you walk them through an example. And that starts to become almost tribal knowledge and general consensus of how this gets done. So you really have to just keep asking questions. And it's a little bit of trial and error with your customers of seeing, how do they approach it, what's working, what's not, and continually getting that feedback until you can move forward and eventually become fairly prescriptive around, here's what works and here's why it works.
You know, I'm always baffled by how fast technology moves, particularly these days. I'm just, to date myself, I'm a product of the 80s. I'm 46. So, you know, I remember big old like Wall Street. Remember that movie, the flip phones? Like, that was not even flip phones, the big one where it's connected to a thing. We're all like, oh my God, that's amazing.
And or then, car like, phones?
Oh my God. My dad had one. I thought it was okay, but we couldn't use it because it cost too much money. That was the right part. but the, you know, that lasted for several years before then it turned into a mobile, like a flip phone. And now it's like every day something in the technology world changes. Like, it's so fast. And I have to imagine you feel the impact of that too. So how do you ensure that Integris and what you're doing isn't falling behind when, like, you're, like, to your point, you're dealing with new territory, and in technology, things are always changing so fast.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a hard one. I think the biggest advantage we have is that we're a young company. And because of that, we've started our company on the latest and greatest software. The companies that are really at a disadvantage are the big companies that have been around for a long time, 10, 20 years.
Yeah, with legacy systems.
Yeah, they've got a whole bunch of technical debt, and their bread and butter, their massive revenue streams are based on technology that's 10, 20, 30 years old. And we're not burdened with that. We're a company that's been born in the cloud. We can operate across different systems. The technology we're using is, yes, it's very new, but it's also bleeding edge. And we have that advantage in that we can solve problems that much larger companies can't solve because we have enabling technology and we're built on technology that lets us do it. So for instance, we can look at data as it's streaming in and streaming out of an organization. That's an incredibly hard thing to do from a technical standpoint, but we can do it because we're using the latest and greatest software in order to inspect it. And so if a big company were trying to solve this problem, they would look at, okay, what data already exists within your company and stop there. Whereas we can say, okay, we can look at what's there, but we can also look at what's moving in and moving out on a regular basis. And that's because we're a younger company built on newer technology and we can be more nimble. So we do have a bit of an advantage there in terms of being able to do things big companies can't do.
That's so cool. I just have this visualization of like colored rivers, digital rivers streaming in and out. That's very cool. And I would imagine too that having been born more recent as a company, you're set up to be more nimble versus like to your point. And I think that's true across a lot of industries where we have all, I like how you said that technical debt, like when you've got structural debt, no matter, and whether that's processes, procedures, technology, whatever it is, it's way harder to make that shift to be nimble than if you start nimble.
Exactly. Exactly. And when you're a large organization, in order to function and be efficient, you necessarily have to build up bureaucracy. And that bureaucracy, while very profitable and helps you operate like a large machine and keeps things very controlled, it's a good thing. It can be a very good thing. But the challenge is you get in the mindset of, well, this is how we do things. This is what we do. We don't do it in different ways. And that mindset and that way of thinking is very limiting. And it makes it hard for those larger companies to jump on opportunities and shifts in a new market like privacy that is evolving and changing every 3 months. Whereas we can be right in the heart of it and say, okay, we're starting to see new patterns emerge, new conversations happening. There's this new legislation out there, which is changing how people think about XYZ. All right, let's adapt the product to make sure we're addressing it. Like companies like ours are just better suited to deal with net new markets, whereas large established markets that have been around for a while. Yeah, if you're a big company, absolutely turn the crank, enjoy the bureaucracy. That's going to make you successful in a very stable, large market, but not in a market like this.
So here's this is going to sound mildly personal, but there's a personal story to it, but it is a business question, I promise, since we are recording. So, you know, the other day I go to the doctor and I get some blood work and the doctor and I are talking and I said something like, can't you just message me and tell me my result? Like, I just wanted to know, right? Just a text, even a Facebook message. Like for me, that's how I interact, right? And she couldn't. She was like, no. And then I had to go through the whole rigmarole of logging into the portal, which is always a hassle because none of the doctor portals are set up to be user-friendly. Like I've never experienced one. How do you balance the reason I'm sharing this, my personal blood work story is how do you balance like that, what you're doing in your business, right? Of data privacy and making sure companies are doing what they need to do with this kind of shift in the marketplace with consumers of how we want to interact. Because I've done a lot of work with customer service organizations and there's this constant battle with like systems and regulations and how consumers, people want to engage because we want to do stuff over text and Facebook and whatever, mm-hmm. You know, yet we want data privacy. So how do you think about, I would love your perspective on how you balance that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. As you were talking, I was thinking about a recent Teladoc appointment we had for our son. Our son got basically an eye infection and we didn't want to have to drive down to the doctor's office and it was 10 o'clock at night.
And
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's had this before. We know exactly what it is. We just need a prescription. And so we Skyped with the doctor, and he said, you know, hold him close to the camera. So we held him close to the camera. And he asked about symptoms, and we're like, yeah, he's had this before. We know what it is. We just need this prescription. He filled the prescription. We went down and got it. And that night we got him on antibiotics, and he was fine. And so there's scenarios where I think folks can do it well, but I think the overriding concern, particularly with healthcare data, is that you do not ever want to mess that up. It's one of the areas where you just can't, because your healthcare data is not going to change. It's not like your buying preferences on an e-commerce site will evolve and change over time. And pretty soon, data that was relevant about you 20 years ago is a lot less relevant today because your life has changed, your buying habits, your preferences have all changed. And so with healthcare data, though, you know, what's personal about you is very different. So I think healthcare is a bit of a special scenario where they are going to be overly cautious and probably to the detriment of customer service. But on the other hand, you kind of have to balance that with, yeah, I'd rather they were a little bit on the overcautious side than more cavalier in terms of how they transmit that information. From our perspective, at least in the privacy world, it's a bit different because there's ways you can approach it that don't stifle innovation, which I think is your overarching point here. It's like, look, there's all this modern technology that's been here for 10, 20 years. Why can't we use it? This is ridiculous.
Exactly.
This is not how the world works. Yes. And so, you know, balancing that, you know, complying with regulations and doing the overly cautious thing with innovation tends to be a challenge. But that said, there are ways that you can do it that are actually very enabling. So, for instance, there's a company we're working with where, as a privacy vendor, we sit upstream from security. So we look at data as it's coming into the organization. We flag any issues that pop up. The security tools then remediate it, either encrypt it, or custom workflows will delete it if they're not supposed to have the data. And in doing that, as the data flows into the system, by the time it reaches a database where you've got data scientists and marketing folks going to town on the data, trying to understand what are their customers doing, how are they buying things, what is their behavior, it's been properly encrypted, it's been properly anonymized, it's been properly secured. And so what we're helping them do effectively is use their data without fear. Because the natural knee-jerk reaction to regulation is, oh, lock it down by default, don't let anybody touch it, you know, treat it with kid gloves, let's put it in a bunker and nobody ever touches it. But that stifles innovation, to your point. And so if you set up the processes properly where you're looking at it in advance and saying, okay, this looks highly sensitive, this needs to be encrypted, or we shouldn't have this, let's delete it because we don't want it even entering the system. And then by the time it gets to the spot where people are using it on a day-to-day basis, it's properly protected, it's been properly culled, and only the stuff that they absolutely need to have is in that data set, they can continue to innovate, but do it in a way that's within compliance of these regulations, but also is still true to their brand and their business and allows them to compete in the market. So there's ways to do it, but you have to think in terms of a structural and potentially design of how your data is flowing in and flowing out that allows you to continue to innovate.
Yeah, and I think I'm glad you kind of talked about it in that way in terms of how it connects to business and brand, because I think, you know, big data is the other kind of buzzword out there right now. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to innovate once you have that data in front of you, if you do it in a way that's smart and safe.
Exactly.
How have innovative methods helped you succeed just in terms of building Integrys?
Yeah, I mean, I think asking lots and lots of questions and always asking people, what is it that bothers you about it? What's keeping you up at night? How are you thinking about it? What are the challenges you're facing? And not just staying at a philosophical level, but actually digging into operationally, what does this actually mean? How is this likely to play out in your organization? And having people walk you through what that looks like, that is incredibly helpful in those qualitative discussions and continuing to have those qualitative discussions, because that'll tell you where the bumps in the road are going to be later on. It's great that you have a buyer that's excited about what you're doing and they want to write a check, but the rubber really hits the road when you have to implement it and operationalize it. And if you don't understand organizational dynamics at a people perspective and what challenges typically exist between different departments within an organization, you can run into all sorts of roadblocks. And so that constant questioning, constant constantly leaving things open-ended is really, really important. And it's what our, it's what I do on a constant basis when I'm talking to customers and customer prospects. And it's what we constantly get feedback from our sales team on, is what are they hearing in response to those types of questions? The other thing is also just watching for patterns. Because if you see a pattern, there's an opportunity. If you, if it's one off, I wouldn't chase it. But if you hear it 3, 4, 5 times, you think, okay, there's a pattern here. There's a real problem. Let's start thinking about how we could possibly solve that problem. And does it fit within the broader mandate of what we're trying to do? Does it align well with the direction we're heading or not? Because if not, don't get distracted chasing shiny objects. Only focus on things that are actually going to help propel you forward in the direction that you're headed. So those are some of the things that we do, just to constantly be listening. And it's really not a let me tell you how great we are and tell you how we do it. It's really a lot of asking questions and then saying, okay, here's how we approach it. You highlighted these specific things that are relevant to us. We think these are other interesting topics. We can make referrals, or here's how other people are doing it, and just try to keep that conversation crafted. But it allows you to fit in with what companies actually need.
I just want to say, actually take a pause and kind of say something back that you just said that I think is really important for us on Launch Street to remember. And you said it so quickly that I want to go back to it. You said the difference kind of between, I'm going to paraphrase, but the difference between like a one-off and patterns, and not chasing one-offs, but actually looking for patterns, because there's opportunity there. And I think oftentimes we make the mistake of chasing one-offs. And I think that's important. So I just want to take a second and go back to that. I wrote it down as you were talking, because I was like, oh, what a great way to wrap it up, because it is very easy to chase one-offs.
Oh yeah, and a market can't be determined based on a sample set of one. You know, you might have one very enthusiastic company who's giving you all sorts of great feedback and lots of warm fuzzies, and you think, Oh yeah, this is indicative of the market. This is awesome. Yeah. This is it. I'm going to be a billionaire. and then you get out there and realize, no, it's just one crazy dude with his own opinions, and it's not actually where there's a market opportunity. Let's reassess.
I'm not gonna lie. I've totally done that. Like, a couple years ago now, a client came to me and was like, I want to do an innovation audit and do this whole thing. And I was like, oh my God, we should totally be doing these innovation audits. Like, I totally bought all the signals and the carrot, and I chased it, and it never came to fruition. A and B, there was no market for it. It's not what people wanted. It was one person who had one thought. And I just, the amount of time and energy, it was a really important lesson to learn around that, what you said about the difference between one-off opportunities, and it may be an opportunity or just a one-off, and really looking for those patterns and seeing the bigger gaps. I have one more question for you around that too. So you had mentioned, like, you need to make sure that you have people that understand organizational dynamics, because to your, I think, story earlier, legal has to work with technology, who has to work with HR, right? Who has to work with the brand people, kind of everything has to connect in data privacy and what you do. How do you make sure in an organization that you're talking to the right people who can actually help you make those decisions and get things implemented, versus kind of like the one-off people who are excited and maybe even get it, but can't operationalize it, or maybe can't even sign the dotted line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a hard one to answer, particularly in a brand new market. You know, in established markets, if we were a security vendor, we would know exactly who we go to. The chief information security officer, obviously. You know, if we were selling a finance tool, you go to the chief financial officer, obviously. But for privacy, because new privacy is both a legal and technology and security and risk and governance issue, there was no real clear buyer for it. And so in the early days, we actually had to do a fair bit of trial and error, you know, selling to different audiences, seeing what moved forward, what didn't. And pretty soon patterns emerged organizationally around who has buying power, who can actually write a check, who can try it out and has the keys to the kingdom to unlock access to these things to actually run it. And where is the responsibility starting to fall? Like, who's going to be the throat that gets choked if something goes wrong? And in the early days of a new market, that is super unclear, especially when the buyer is a non-obvious one. But we have started to see those patterns emerge. And what we're seeing is that given how big the market is, there's a lot of different vendors doing lots of different pieces of it. And depending on the piece that they're working on, there is a different buyer. And that may consolidate over time, but we definitely have a different buyer than some of the other vendors out there. But that is just, it's straight up trial and error and seeing what moves forward and who's got clout. And so in terms of finding someone who's going to be able to write a check, you need a combination of things. One, they have to be senior enough to make strategic investment decisions. Two, they have to have enough organizational influence that they can bring other departments along and say, no, no, this is necessary. We have to do it. And here's why. And then number three, they have to be in a position to actually implement it, run it, and use it, and it be their team. Because if you've got one person buying it in one department and it's a different department that's running it, what's going to happen is you become shelfware, because nobody in a position of authority can actually force anybody else to do it. But if your buyer is also the one running it, well, then you're in a much better position.
Well, it's I think a lot with new product development is the same thing. If you're the one creating the idea, but the people who have to implement the idea aren't involved, there's no buy-in and nobody wants more to do, regardless if it's the right thing to do or not. That actually doesn't matter. And it becomes this one-way tennis match of like, I'm going to lob this tennis ball of this new data privacy solution over to you. And they're like, duck and weave. I don't want anything to do with that.
Run. I don't like tennis anyways. I'm leaving. Totally. I'm going to have mimosas and sit at the side of the court.
And I think it's hard if you're the one who buys in, because you don't understand why the people on the other side of the court won't do it when it's the right thing to do. But it has everything to do with like the impact that you've been pushing onto them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I want to ask you some questions about kind of being a woman in getting VC money and startup and technology in particular. And just before I do that, I just want to close the loop on this part of the conversation to say that, you know, I think the insight I'm taking away from this, aside from, you know, an important conversation about data privacy, is this need to look for patterns. You mm-hmm. mentioned it multiple times, which is in itself a pattern, by the way. you know, no pun intended, or every totally intended.
That's so meta.
You know, like, I know, right? So, you know, the pattern in kind of the opportunity, the pattern in the buyer, the pattern in the solutions. And I think for all of us trying to innovate and look for opportunities to, you know, solve big challenges and move our businesses forward, or the businesses we work for, really taking a breath and looking for patterns across all of it, I think is so important. So thank you for putting that, because I hadn't really thought about that as deeply as I was just during this conversation. So I wanted to kind of, like I said, talk to you a little bit about being a woman in VC, because I think you have this in technology. I think you have an incredible perspective that only a small percent actually do. So one of the things that we're, I think, hearing more and more about in the news is how women receive far less VC money than men. And I think a lot of that's coming out of kind of Silicon Valley news and you know, kind of technology specific. And I think it was, the last I read was, what, 4.4% of VC funding goes to women only, I should say 4.4%. And I think the average is $935,000, which for men, I think it's 2.1 million, I think, if my number's right. So talk a little bit about from your perspective and share some advice you have for, you know, I'd say women as innovators, not just getting funding, but kind of pushing ideas and themselves forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think the thing to keep in mind is at least getting funding for the VC industry, their whole job is pattern matching. Like, that's it. You heard me mention patterns probably 5, 6, 7 times already, and it's not surprising. I spent years in VC. We look for our patterns, because patterns form markets. So show me the pattern of behavior. Show me the repeatability in this problem. Show me how this becomes big, because the market economics for a VC fund are that you have to assume every single investment you make has the potential to become a $1 billion outcome. So you have to have conviction that company you're investing in is going to be the next IPO-able big thing, because the hit rates are like 1 in 20 becomes a $1 billion IPO-able company. And so because of those odds, what you're looking for in an entrepreneur is somebody who swings for the fences and has a big vision, but can also execute on the near term. And that, showing up with that kind of confidence in your ability to go after those huge markets takes some combination of extreme confidence, but also lunacy, quite frankly, on the part of the entrepreneur. Like, totally. You have to show up and say, yeah, I'm going to be the next big deal. And here's why this is a $1 billion market opportunity and you don't want to miss out. And quite frankly, you know, not to get into stereotypes here, it's not something that women are typically great at doing, because women are, you know, conditioned to be very self-effacing and self-deprecating and, you know, maybe I might do this, and we're taught that that's how you're supposed to talk, but that's not effective when you're pitching for money. So that's one thing. The other flip side of that is because VCs are pattern matchers, they're looking for what has been successful in the past. And that includes really hard, you know, hard concrete things like, are they pursuing a net new market? Are they pursuing something that's truly differentiated? Are they taking advantage of a major market shift? They look for those patterns. But at the end of the day, it boils down to gut feel about the entrepreneur. And I don't think it's out of any kind of maliciousness or overt sexism, but when you see somebody who walks in and looks like Zuckerberg wearing a hoodie, Stanford grad, I've got this billion-dollar idea, they fit a pattern. And your gut is going to say, oh, yeah, they're fitting a pattern. I feel confident in them because I've seen this pattern play out before and I made money on it before. Whereas if you see someone who's a minority walk in, a woman, a person of color, both, you might think, ah, this doesn't fit a pattern. Something is discordant in this pitch. I can't quite put my finger on it, but my gut feel is telling me this isn't quite right. And so it's that I think becomes a stumbling block for people who are minorities. And it's that I think ends up having these smaller checks getting written when they do raise is a little bit more conservatism because that person doesn't fit a pattern that they know. And that's the issue. Like when you work in VC, you'll hear phrases like, well, they walk like a duck, talk like a duck, must be a world-class CEO, or that's a CEO out of central casting right there. And that builds confidence because they fit a pattern of behavior, persona, looks, dress, demeanor. And that's a big challenge. So I don't think it's a malicious thing. I think it boils down to gut feel. And ultimately, VCs make money off of their gut feel opinions. You know, there's only so much the data can tell you before you could actually have to make a bet on a person in an industry. And so the way I've dealt with that and going in knowing that and knowing that there is that unconscious bias that exists in the industry is I spend a disordinate amount of time getting to know investors well in advance of fundraising. And I mean like a year to several years in advance of ever asking them for a check. Because what I found is that it's easy to pass judgment on categories of people and groups of people. It's very hard to pass judgment on someone when you know them individually. And you, right? And you get to know people and you force them to get to know you by having these, hey, I'm not fundraising, but I just want to make sure I get to know folks in advance. If I'm going to give somebody a board seat, I want to make sure I know them well and know their character and how they operate. I'd love to go grab a coffee with you and give you an update on what we're doing. And you just stay in touch and you have multiple touch points with them well in advance of ever needing money. If you're meeting them for the first time when you're going out fundraising, you've met them way too late. And that's a general rule for everybody, but it's particularly true for minorities because you want them to know you as a person so that gut reaction is, I've got confidence in that individual, not, oh, there's just something not quite right. I can't put my finger on it, but I don't have the confidence to place the bet. They're going to be able to place a bet on somebody that they know, and that can be you. But it takes extra work.
I think what you're saying is really powerful because it's a really unconscious level of thinking. Like to your point, they're not having that conversation when I walk in the room about me. It's just like, oh, she doesn't fit the pattern of what we know and what we've done in the past. And what we really need to think about isn't just the stats and the numbers, but how do we break those patterns so when we do walk into the room, that changes. And then hopefully over time, right, we become part of the pattern as well.
Exactly. Exactly. And it takes more legwork in advance. And, you know, that's part of the woman tax or the minority tax, however you want to look at it. But it is necessary in order to break through it.
Yeah. And I really appreciate what you're saying about, and I'm not going to say it as eloquently as you did about like, we can make judgments about groups, but it's harder to make those blanket judgments about an individual once you get to know them. And, I think that's very true in business in general too, of, you know, really, you know, it's that kind of like a running joke about like business is built on the golf course, it's built on relationships, but it's true. I don't know about the golf course anymore, but definitely about relationships. That's how it's built. And if you want to overcome the bias that you know you're going to deal with, you got to start on a more one-on-one level.
Well, exactly. And, you know, even folks who aren't out raising venture funding, but who are working at organizations with, you know, management structures, what you'll find is that lots of people will mentor you if you're a minority, but very few people will become your champion. Mm. And wow. The reason I think that is that they'll champion for people who they can make assumptions about because they went to the same school. They also like football. Right. You know, they look the same. They joke around the same. They've got that rapport. And because of all of those superficial things, they feel much more confident that that other person is like them. That more junior person is a younger version of them. Whereas it takes a lot more work to get to know someone who superficially is different from you. But once you dig a little bit deeper, you might find, actually, no, we've got a lot in common and they're actually the right person to bet on. And so when you're in a large organization, you might find that management structures and senior execs will champion for people who are very similar to them superficially, but not for people who are different. And that's where I see that gender gap and race gap happening in large organizations is that once you get to a certain level in the organization, everybody's smart, everybody's competent, everybody's really good at your job. And what differentiates you is having somebody higher up willing to champion for you to get you the really big projects and say, I believe in this person, they can do it. Let's put them forward and put them in charge of this. I think they've got what it takes. And that takes a lot more effort to get to know someone on that level to place that kind of a bet where the senior person staking their reputation on the junior person. And so you see this pattern play out in all sorts of ways where people feel like they hit a glass ceiling and it's there and it's not because they're not worthy of it. It's because people are just less likely to place a bet on someone who superficially is different because it takes more work to get to know them. And it's easy to make those superficial judgments and assume that someone's a good person simply because of how they look.
Yeah, I think it's the birds of a feather mentality, and it happens all over the place. And it's very natural because we're tribal humans. But to your point, like that means, hey, let's make some effort to make that happen. Although it's interesting, the difference between mentorship and championship. That's I hadn't really thought of it that way.
Yeah, it's challenge impactful. On that.
Yeah, yeah. I can't believe we're almost out of time. So where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
Twitter is a good spot. So I'm at Christina with a K and Kerr, K-E-R-R at the end on Twitter or LinkedIn. We're constantly posting stuff about what we're doing and what we're up to and what our thoughts are there. And then, of course, our website if you're interested in privacy. But Twitter and LinkedIn are probably the best spots.
Awesome. We'll put all those links in the show notes. So I'm going to switch up my last question for you because I want to ask you about patterns. So my final question is, what is your piece of advice for us innovators out there trying to find those patterns? Like, what advice do you have for us to figure out patterns?
Yeah, I would say start with the big shifts. What is the macroeconomic shift that's happening globally? Like, is there a change in public opinion? Is there a new wave of technology? Is there something big that's happening globally that will have downstream ripple effects? Because in those big changes and those big shifts are opportunities of a million different kinds. And what you need to do is leverage your network, your expertise to figure out how does this major shift apply to where I can add value and where I have specific differentiated expertise in the market, because that's where you're going to find your big opportunity.
I love it. Christina, thank you so much for coming by Launch Street. This was totally insightful. So thank you.
Having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.